and a very good evening to you. Welcome to the Global Digest, a 1 hour show that basically looks at what is happening in the news cycle and also current affairs, a program or events around the world, regionally and locally, where we get basically to discuss anything that is happening, as in the latest developments. Like the previous weeks, we've been looking at what is happening in Haiti and also here in Kenya. I'm joined by my wonderful colleagues, of course, David Sayega and Irene Mwangi. Hi, guys. Karibuni sana. One of the things that, of course, we are looking forward to this week is a conversation that has taken shape in the region. A conversation that probably Irene likes the most, because it has something to do with discussing about the age of our leaders and stuff like that. But also, today we are joined by our colleague in the newsroom, Jeremiah Okaya. He is our online editor, deals with multimedia. He's a multimedia journalist. It's kind of difficult to put all these titles to someone who you call your friend. So now you kind of have to put other titles to him. So Jeremiah has a passion in international affairs, constitutional litigation, and governance. In a word, Jeremiah, maybe you can shorten that introduction for me. How should people interact with you?
No, that was quite accurate.
Okay. So we could proceed. Thank you very much. So the show is usually just a chat amongst friends. We usually give you what happens in our newsroom, the conversations we have in our newsroom when we are just trying to brainstorm a story and stuff like that. And the first topic where we are looking at the conversation between regional balance, ethnic balance, and does it take a toll on competency, is actually something that came up when we were in the newsroom last week. And it emerged that the now sworn in chief registrar of the judiciary, Ms. Frida Mukaya, there was someone who had a dissenting opinion based on the fact that he felt that the chief registrar and the deputy registrar come from the same region. Is that true? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're the one who kind of pointed it out. Maybe you can open the conversation up from that point.
Yeah, that was quite interesting, though. So Madam Mukaya has been sworn in today. She takes over as the chief registrar of the judiciary, the third under the constitutional dispensation we have now that we enacted in 2010. You will recall that Anne Amadi retired in January after serving for 10 years. She secured a second term. And there was a very interesting conversation after the interviews conducted on Monday last week, because, of course, the announcement came early morning on Thursday. In fact, we were getting reports of her appointment without, you know, the statement. The statement came much later.
Yeah.
And it later emerged that one of the commissioners in the Judicial Service Commission wasn't quite on board with the decision that the commission had taken.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in fact, insisted on giving a dissenting opinion should the majority of the commissioners feel that they need to proceed in the manner they did. But of course, we overcame that, so we have a new CRJ.
Yeah.
But there's a very interesting conversation, I mean a very interesting argument the commissioner was advancing, the issue of whether or not the CRJ and the deputy CRJ could come from the same region. And the argument was regional balancing and all that. But I think it is important to note that in terms of regional balancing, I think the the ultimate, when we actually look at these numbers, including even from the public service, the conversation we tend to have is overall in an organization, how do you balance the opportunities in an organization?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should then go to as far as, you know, contesting whether or not you can have a leader and their deputy from the same community.
So can you pick it up from there? So how do you actually balance? Do you look from the top to the bottom, or do you go per department, like the office of the Chief Justice, the CJ, DCJ, the office of the Chief Registrar, la la la. Then the what do you call them? The head of Court of Appeal, head of High Court, head of, where does the conversation of competency come in?
I think ultimately the commission is guided by, you know, because you have a shortlisting process. In this particular exercise, you had 47 candidates.
Mm-hmm.
They narrowed down to the 7 that were interviewed. So that tells you that the guiding principle here is competency. Are these people competent enough to serve in? And then, of course, other considerations come in.
Mm-hmm.
But on the question of regional balancing, it is also important to understand where we came from as a country. You know, the Krigler report after the 2007, 2008 post-election violence, one of the issues that emerged was the issue of over-representation of certain ethnic communities and groups in public service, right? And regional balancing is about balancing opportunities in our country among different communities so that one community does not feel overrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it may be far-fetched to imagine that, you know, you would expect to have that conversation at the level of, you know, on the hierarchy of an institution, so that you say, okay, so-and-so comes from this region, then their deputy or directors in certain, you know, cannot come from, yeah. But that's an argument that keeps coming up whenever we have these processes.
It is an argument, especially in the public service.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not wrong, when Robinson Githae was the finance minister under President Kibaki, there's a time he was called before parliament, and the allegations he had to respond to was there was an ethnic community that had the lion's share of appointments or staff members in the National Treasury, and his response was, we can't help it, in the sense that when we are always advertising, we can't help that these people are the ones who are always, answering to our call. They are the ones who are qualified in that field. For instance, there is another group. If you advertised for professors and engineers, they are the ones who will show up.
Mm-hmm.
If you advertised for, chefs, there's another group that will show up. So the conversation around affirmative action, because regional balance is just a must way of saying affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
Does affirmative action necessarily have to mean that we lower the standards in terms of competency? Davis, Irene.
I think when it comes to this discussion, it's a good discussion. It's an interesting one for that matter. But I think we need to understand that the Constitution addresses the importance of ensuring that these two elements are adhered to. The Constitution is very clear in ensuring that there is equal ethnic representation when it comes to public staffing in public offices. But also the same constitution gives priority when it comes to matters of merit. So when I look at the case of the new Chief of Registrar, Mokaya,
mm-hmm.
I think the commission, as much as yes, there was a dissenting opinion from one of the commissioners, I think the issue of merit, meritocracy was given prominence when it came to the hiring of this new Chief Registrar. Because really the Constitution, just like I have highlighted, it gives prominence to the issue of merit, regardless of which community you're coming from, regardless of whether your deputy also comes from the same region.
Okay, you'll stand to correct me. One of the people who had been shortlisted among the 7 was the acting CRJ, someone who had acted for 8 years. Correct?
Not really, for a month and a half. He's actually the deputy CRJ, so yeah, he continues to.
As deputy CRJ, he served for?
Yeah.
For 8 years. We can say something like 8 years. Also, there was someone who was the chief of staff, and at least ADPA, the chief of staff to the CJ. And there were basically people who had some sort of, you could say, people who had clout that they were bringing into the room.
I think sometimes the longevity of your service does not necessarily guarantee your position in government.
Mm-hmm.
Wakaya has extensively covered the courts. He will tell you most definitely that there are certain modalities which were used in getting the new chief of registrar.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of how many years other competitors have served in the same position or in similar positions, could not really guarantee them the position. So obviously, there are certain elements that the commission during the recruitment process looked at and came to the conclusion that indeed, Mokaya is a competent individual who is able, who can ably succeed Amadi. So I think the issue of, back to the constitution again, yes, as much as a nation we need to ensure there is fair distribution of this position among different communities,
mm-hmm.
we must not forget the importance of merit. We need to give people who deserve these positions.
Adrian.
I think I will not get into what Wakaya and Davis here have quite elaborated, but I think the 2010 constitution failed to address the issue of public appointments when you consider the issue of ethnicity, because Article 27 of the constitution prescribes that you cannot exclude somebody based on their ethnicity, which was the case in the dissenting opinion by one of the commissioners in JSE. But Article 232 of the Constitution says that there needs to be a proper representation in terms of the ethnic communities, which I think the same commissioner was trying to portray, to say, okay, we can't have two communities serve at this particular position. How about we appoint somebody else to take up this particular position. So you can see the conflicting angles of viewing it. In case it was in a court of law, somebody will argue it based on Article 27, that she cannot be excluded. Another one will argue that, okay, yes, she cannot be excluded, but we cannot have two communities serve on that particular post.
Mm-hmm.
So from that particular aspect, I see as if the constitution sort of clash. It will be based on how, if it's in a court of law, how the lawyers will argue their case before the judges. So that's how I see it. But again, when you look recently, there has been, since the deputy president Rigathi Gachagua had this sentiment of shareholding, and therefore the communities that voted for this government should have, you know, post plan positions in government. There has been the issue of narrowing research on which communities hold positions in the public service, and the Kalenjin and Kikuyu communities were the top leading, to the extent that the recent appointments of the KRA interns were nullified by the courts based on the fact that the appointment was skewed between two particular communities. But then somebody will argue, there was a the MD, the CEO actually of NSSF, who was being questioned by senators why a community like Bajuni, the corner of this country in Lamu, are not part of the technical workforce in NSSF. And he argued it's because there is no one who is educated to fill those particular posts, and therefore the ethnic balance cannot apply on that particular aspect, given that the majority of people in these communities are not well educated to fill the technical post in certain key institution in government.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on how you see it, but from where I see it, I feel like the constitution did not quite argue it well when it comes to ethnic balance.
Do you agree?
I think ultimately, Laban, and maybe just to go back to the JSC, we had 7 shortlisted candidates. Mm-hmm. The very fact that they've been shortlisted means they are competent.
Yeah.
Either of them could have.
Just on that, yeah.
Yes.
When I was actually looking at PSC, Public Service Commission, Parliamentary Service Commission, whenever they do their listings,
yes,
they usually also include the region someone is coming from. Unfortunately for JSC, someone forgot that column. Because I think it's usually very important to include it. Because I've seen certain instances, for instance, for IEBC, whereby the column is included, and then when people are being kicked out, they're being kicked out on, we already have someone from for instance Nyanza or Central or Eastern, yeah.
Perhaps that's the grey area in law, and we leave the law to the lawyers, mm-hmm, really. But the issue is, and again, you go back to how the JSC goes through this process. Ultimately, the commissioners in the panel would score the candidates, and I would imagine that's how they arrive at the winning candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, you have 7 candidates, all of whom are competent. In fact, These are people who are actually serving, most of them within the judiciary. You know, mm-hmm, you had the chief of staff in the office of the CJ. You had Mokaya herself had served in the system as the magistrate and gone up. So ultimately, it is how the commission decides in their own wisdom, decides to go about this. Perhaps in this particular case, they were not preoccupied with the issue of which region must this candidate come from. It boiled down to who scored the highest in the interviews, and that's quite in order. I think from where I sit, the issue should be ethnic balancing as far as distribution of opportunities within the judiciary, mm-hmm, I mean in the larger judiciary. So talking about judges in general, judicial staff, you know, everyone, mm-hmm, the support staff, including drivers. I would be surprised if you have, 50% of drivers in that institution from a certain corner of the country,
mm-hmm,
because that would then point to a clear, you know.
But they always say everything starts at the top. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's rotting, it's supposed to start at the top. So if at the top, there are people who are saying, I was surprised no one raised an issue towards gender, but then you'd argue that there's already, on this, on the executive side, it's already male dominated. So there's no harm in having like almost a whole judiciary led by ladies. But anyway.
By the way, judiciary is one of the most balanced institutions in the country. If you look at their numbers, I think they are almost at par, 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very small, in terms of gender representation.
But I think, Laban, even as we're having this discussion, I think it is important to remind all of us that emphasis on diversity should not be at the expense of merit.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like Irene pointed out, there is need for some serious retrospection as a country on how we need to look at some of these things,
mm-hmm,
in terms of the recruitment process in the public sector. So I think going forward, to avoid such issues like the one that we've had in the judiciary, where Wakaya is aptly agitated because of... there needs to be some guidelines, perhaps, that will either come from the Public Service Commission itself, or it can be driven from Parliament, where there needs to be a cap or some set of guidelines, really, that will be able to guide these panels in the recruitment process in the public sector on how to handle the recruitment process in the event where there is merit and the need for ethnic representation, fair ethnic representation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Allow me to take a break, and then we'll come back to you in a minute.
Hey Nairobi, it's Mapul on Capital FM's Breakfast Show. Now, Stanbic Bank Kenya is about to change the way you save. Imagine up to 14% interest per annum on your savings, calculated daily and paid monthly. Plus, enjoy flexibility with the Pure Savings account. Share your savings plan for a chance to win 5,000 shillings daily. Your financial goals are within reach with Stanbic Bank. Just SMS SAVE to 22208 or visit Stanbic Bank. Stay tuned to The Breakfast Show with me, McBull, for more details and win big with Stanbic Bank Savings Account.
Capital FM.
And welcome back to the Global Digest with myself, Laban, my colleagues Davis, Irene, and of course Wakaya, Jeremiah. Irene, before we went for the break, you had a point.
I wanted to say there's a bill that is being fronted by Mandera West Member of Parliament, Adan Yusuf, on the national cohesion and integration to ensure that a public service entity does not employ more than a fifth of the staff from the same community. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure how well that bill will receive support from members of parliament, because again, political interference is a big stake when it comes to these issues. Yeah. And it's always like whenever a government comes in, it's like it is our time. But you see, when you look at it and you look at what they say it is our time, only like four communities have the opportunity to have their time when it comes to controlling the government. Mm-hmm. So it's a wait and see situation whether that bill will see the light of day, and maybe it might cure the issue concerning public service appointment, now that I think maybe the constitution wasn't clear in terms of now breaking down how this should come into force.
Is it an issue that the constitution was not clear,
mm-hmm.
or the people who are supposed to be implementing the constitution just do not have the will? The National Cohesion and Integration Commission, mm-hmm. is not a new body. It is something that is there. The only thing that I found interesting with that bill is why are they bringing a bill to repeal the current the 2008 one to bring a new one? Is it that NCIC has failed to do its job to ensure that there is cohesiveness in not only the public service but also in the counties? The argument you've made it at national level,
mm-hmm.
but I'm sure if we went across the room, you will actually argue that at the county level, it's where the issue of representation has not even been scratched. It's not even near 2%.
It's not the issue of insufficient laws here in the country. I think we have enough laws. The issue is the enforcement. Even if the previous act that they're seeking to repeal was not quite addressing some of these concerns, it was not implemented from the first place. So we're just seeing a situation whereby somebody is trying to push the enforcement aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
but again, without goodwill and the political interference, it will still remain the same script. I think there was a shortage in terms of regulations, to the extent that if we are having parastatals like KRA, let me mention the recent one that we have,
mm-hmm.
for us to have two communities get the huge chunk of the opportunities in terms of the KRA interns appointment, yet we are having laws in place to ensure that there is no imbalance when it comes to ethnic representation. It just shows that, again, the issue of enforcement, that it takes the High Court to nullify the process, yet it could have been nullified from the board level when KRA was having this particular advertisement and the shortlisting and what have you. So it's not an issue of insufficient laws. It's just about the issue of goodwill. Mm-hmm. And you always see somebody come up with a bill, not to cure something that has not been there, but just tweaking a thing here or there just to show that we are going for this.
But I think this one is timely because it tends to cure that whole issue of clarity in ensuring that when doing the recruitment process, you're supposed to do one or two or three things. And I think if the bill does not have this proposal, I think it is important for it to be captured. There is need for public recruitment agencies, key in point the Public Service Commission, for this particular discussion, for it to be insulated against political interference that Irene had mentioned about. So I think members of parliament have a role to play here in supporting the bill. And it will be interesting to watch out, to look out for the Kikuyu members of parliament, the Kalenjin members of parliament, where they will be standing when it comes to the debate and the subsequent approval or rejection of this bill.
Okay, are we over-legislating?
Well, I mean, when you look at the general framework of the constitution,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of equality and freedom from discrimination, anticipates that we are going to make certain interventions, either to secure, you know, whether for affirmative action. And that's why, for instance, the issue of the two-thirds still remains hanging to date, because the Constitution anticipated that we would have a framework to attain that. I think it's the same thing regarding the issue of regional balancing and ethnic representation, if you want to call it that. Prefer to call it regional balancing. So, yes, I think it's upon our members of parliament to seal gaps where they see we do have gaps.
Okay. Davis, we will have to take the break so that you can do the news bulletin at 7 o'clock. It is 7 o'clock and it's time for the news. And welcome back to Global Digest with myself, Labanon Ambisi, Irene Mwangi, Davis Aega, and of course, Jeremiah Wakaya. We were talking about the issue of gender regional representation, which is just another way of veiling the conversation around how do we ensure that our ethnic groups in the country are well represented in government institutions from national to county. Can we just take the conversation a bit lower to the county level, whereby the thing that mainly dictates whether you're going to get a seat sometimes is from which clan you're from. And how then does the bill that Irene has mentioned, how does that then get to address the issue of clanism in government appointment? Because ideally, you're just bringing that conversation of regional balance down to the counties. Anyone?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite interesting. In fact, I think recently during the conversation around NADCO, certain factions emerged demanding for counties in certain regions of this country. Yeah. I think Migori, we had fellows from Kuria demanding for a county. There were sentiments by a section of voters from Trans Nzoia demanding for a county. And we have to face this as a country, that tribalism and clanism is deep-rooted in our society. In fact, you would actually have a situation where certain groups of individuals would disown one of their own because who has landed a national appointment because they do not necessarily come from their clan or the predominant clan from a certain region. And these things are quite prevalent in counties where you have, of course, larger dominant ethnic groups excluding others. Even where you have a single ethnic grouping, you would be, you know, you will realize that there are subgroups within these ethnic groupings. Mm-hmm. And within those subgroups, you have dominant subgroups and, you know, less dominant ones. So these are conversations that we should be cascading to counties.
Yeah, Davis.
I think the drafters of the new constitution tried to cure this whole issue of national unity. Now, unfortunately, the decentralization has birthed a more disenfranchised society in terms of when we are trying to look at this whole issue of ethnic representation, because clearly counties have become notorious when it comes to not adhering to this whole issue of regional balance. Like Wakaya has mentioned, there are different communities in the country that have different subgroups. So when you look at the employment that is being done in counties, for instance, like there was a past report which highlighted how Moi University, for example, the main campus in Eldoret, has employed only Kalenjins.
Predominant.
The Kalenjins are the predominant workforce there. So I think really for an effective system of governance, especially down at the local units, the 47 county governments, the governors need to take charge in ensuring that the workforce there is fairly and equally represented. And this will, in the long term, ensure that there's improved input, the work is being done, and then the issues of corruption, because really, when we are talking about solving corruption in the country, these are some of the issues that we need to address. We need to ensure that people employed in a certain department are not coming from the same region. But when you have cases in the same department, 10 or 5 or even more, the possibility of corruption being rampant in that department is very high. But when you have a Kisi, a Luya, a Luo, a Kikuyu, then that is a discussion we are supposed to have as a nation, because it will go a long way in ensuring that this vice is curtailed.
You almost sound like what happens in the Bible when God decided to mix everyone up when he realized people are building the Tower of Babel.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. Irene, you wanted to say something?
No, I wanted to say that some of the counties that have been successful in terms of regional balance is the northern region counties, because when you look at how they plan their elections, it's all about clanism. In terms of, we say the governor will come from this clan, mm-hmm. and then the deputy governor from this clan. It goes all the way to the CECs and even to the appointments, to the extent that when a study was done by NCAC, they seemed to be a balance in terms of communities that have been the community with lower population, let me put it at that, and those that have a high population, so that such that there is a balance from the very onset. But when it comes to these other counties whereby we like counties that are not cosmopolitan that have two communities, say in Migori where we have Kuria's and Luos, if the Luos are dominant, they will continue to reign on that county for years until Kuria's can meet the numbers by the Luo community. So again, I'll go ahead and say it is very hard, as Wakaya said, to run away from the issue of ethnicity, because we vote along tribal lines, so it will cascade even to the appointments. So unless we employ the tactic by the northern counties, which again will not work to our benefit, because they have their way of governance since the very beginning, it will be quite hard for us to create a balance. And that's why we're having communities come out and say that we want our own counties, mm-hmm. including the Suba and the Luos, who you will perceive to be one community. The Suba will say, no, we are not Luos. Luos are not part of us. So again, if we take that trajectory, mm-hmm. each community, even the Kikuyus, we have the Embus, the Kikuyus, then we have the Merus and what have you, will start agitating for their own, you know, counties.
If you actually went back to 2009, 2010, when the conversation around how many counties should we have and what should be the demarcation, you'll actually find that there are communities that made a compelling case on why they should be given a county for themselves, and why if you actually look at the naming of the counties, it's actually telling you that this was a conversation that had a give and take, and at some point they just decided, since we can't give you a county, how about we give you a county that has two names that kind of represent the people who are there, even the constituencies, same difference. But the point that you've made, and even the bill that you said, kind of just makes my point that if you actually looked at it, you are putting merit in the back burner first, and then ticking the regional box or the ethnic box first, and then bringing back merit on the table. Mm-hmm. But if you, where we started from, JSC, one of the things that Macharia Njeru was accused of is he is only crying over spilled milk because the candidate he gave higher marks was not the one who was settled on.
But I think ultimately, political will is is the main factor here in ensuring that there's the need to strike that balance when it comes to ethnic regional representation and meritocracy. When there's sufficient political will coming from the top, then I think that discussion of gauging between regional representation and merit will in a sense be cured, because we'll have to look at what do we give prominence to. And I think that is why the bill by the member of parliament is timely, because it tends to bring about the whole issue of clarity. Mm-hmm. Because as presently things stand at the constitution, merit is given prominence as opposed to regional representation.
But I think merit does not count really. Let me just put something. Merit does not count really. Let me remind the country that Chebukati was number 6 in the shortlisting of the IBC commissioners. Mm-hmm. And he became number 1. I don't understand which gauge former President Uhuru Kenyatta used to put the candidate from number 6 to number 1. But it boils down to political will.
Yeah.
So I think in the country you have to accept that political will comes first beyond anything else. That's why we will have a Chesa, who is a class 6 student, sit in the cabinet. It's all about politics.
It's all about politics. It's all about political will. And
unfortunately, us as a nation, even the topmost leaders of this country, they tend to reward loyalty as opposed to these other things we are talking about. Mm. Case in point, our very own president, William Ruto, is well known for rewarding loyalty as opposed to looking at other issues of merit and regional representation.
So you're actually making my point.
Yeah.
But he has tried.
That in certain conversations, we didn't look at merit.
Yeah.
But in JSC, probably, and I would have loved to see if that whole issue had been prosecuted in a court of law, then, the JSC would have come before a court of law and made their case. This is what we looked at. This is the criteria we used to arrive at this candidate before 8 o'clock, because that's the time we started seeing the name of Ms. Frida being thrown around on social media.
I think part of the guidelines that we need as a nation going forward, the recruiting panels, case in point now this one, JSE, after the recruitment process is concluded, they need to publicize the scorecard of every candidate so that we can be able to argue from a point of information that Mokaya got to that position because the other close candidate failed to impress the panel on some of the issues which maybe the panel needed to be addressed. So I think part of the regulations that we need going forward, there needs to be transparency. After the recruitment process is done, let members of the public, let Kenyans know this is the scorecard and we use these modalities to gauge the candidates. I don't know if Wakaya
but they always decline.
We will agree to that school of thought.
Well, I guess, and you also have to understand, Kenyans are very, at the slightest provocation, somebody would move to court. Mm-hmm. I think you'd have to give it to the JSC. JSC processes, by and large, have remained above board. In fact, I think other than this particular exercise for the CRJ, we've had interviews broadcasted publicly. You know, remember the hiring of the Supreme Court Justice, then later CJ Koome. These processes, they have made quite an attempt compared to other state institutions, especially
public service.
In the public service.
Yeah.
I think there's an attempt from the JSE to make some of these processes, to make the public actually have confidence. And most of these things are actually, by the way, about confidence building.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, if the public and stakeholders in the system don't have confidence in the process, then you have problems. But when you make a decision and key majority of stakeholders. In this particular case, you had lawyers owning the process, lauding the process as transparent, as credible.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately that helps.
My only beef with them was they didn't allow live television into the room. Mm-hmm. I think that also wins some sort of public confidence. Mm-hmm. When we see Honorable Wakaya sitting before the panel and answering to questions, what he thinks of a certain issue, or a certain issue was brought before him and he didn't handle it in the. It kind of helps holding you into account. One of the things that, of course, Irene has mentioned is negotiated democracy and whether it should be what we are applying. And when moving on to the next topic, of course, it is something that more or less touches on negotiated democracy, in that we recently had, I think it was two weeks ago, when Rwanda, the ruling party in Rwanda, announced that it has endorsed President Kagame to run for another term in office. And while we were still taking that in, last week, I think on Thursday or Friday, we heard that Uganda's President Museveni had decided to appoint his son, Muhoozi, to be the head of the military. I don't know. These two developments, does it in a way give you a sense that there is no succession planning within the African leadership?
First of all, these two gentlemen, what they have in common is that President Yoweri Museveni and Paul Kagame, they are among the longest serving presidents in Africa. Museveni mm-hmm. has served for 38 years. Mm-hmm. Kagame is now on the 24th, and that is likely to get an extension with the support that he got from the party. And I think even as we're having this discussion about democracy in Africa, the absence of succession planning, especially when it comes to the countries such as Rwanda and Uganda, is the mere fact that this is likely not to bolster the democracy that has been adopted by other African countries, like here in Kenya, where we have easily accepted and gelled into transitioning democracy, where we get to hold elections, and after every election, there's a smooth transition. The difference between us and Uganda, for example, they do have elections, but now the problem when it comes to the elections is that the President Yoweri Museveni has stifled the opposition, has stifled media freedom. We are seeing the opposition candidates not given the opportunity to express themselves. When we go to Rwanda, same thing. They get to hold elections, but because of the nature of the authoritarian rule exhibited by President Paul Kagame, the issues of democracy are not well articulated. And these two leaders, at the same time, they are very vocal about their critique when it comes to the Western countries. Mm-hmm. The Western countries try as much as possible to advocate for democracy, but these other two leaders are opposed to democracy. Democracy, when it comes to their definition, is majoritarian dictatorship. But I think going forward, they need to relook on how they get to embrace succession planning when it comes to giving opportunities to other leaders. Most importantly, giving the electorate the opportunity to decide on what kind of leaders they want to elect when it comes to elections in Africa.
Wakaya, when I mentioned succession planning, and I thought when Davis was saying these two leaders have something in common, mm-hmm. I was making reference to these two leaders, in a way, got their countries they used military
force,
yes, they kind of rescued, in quotes, mm-hmm. their nation from a regime that basically had ruined whatever was there. And the reason why I'm saying succession planning is, at one point they must be thinking, I will leave, natural attrition, or by just resigning, and
or even death, God forbid.
That's what natural attrition.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting, but one of the issues you have to look at is how somebody comes to power. And if you look at Museveni's journey as as a freedom fighter, so to say, when they hosted the administration in Kampala and he assumed office. One of the arguments he made at the time is, we have a problem with African leaders overstaying in power.
Mm-hmm.
With time, he ended up doing exactly that, through constitutional amendments to remove, you know, limits that would actually have hampered him from continuing in office. And so there are two issues. Some of these leaders would see continuity as the surest way to guarantee progress in their countries. And you'll have to give it to Kagame, for instance, for transforming Rwanda to what it is today. But the problem with that model is, so what happens in his absence? And that's a question people keep asking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've done so well for your country, but there are certain aspects, their democratic credentials have been put to question. Museveni, for instance, has not left doubt about his preferred successor.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he has referred to his son, General Muhoozi, who has risen rapidly through the ranks to become a general, as his avenger. So he sees Muhoozi as somebody who is meant to avenge for him, from what, somebody may ask.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for some of these leaders, it's probably a fear, genuine or selfish, that in their absence, the country would go the wrong way. And so we are only left to imagine what would happen, what transitions in those countries would be like. Because here in Kenya, we, at least for the past 2 decades, we have seen transitions. After Moi left office, we have had peaceful transfer of power, and it's part of that tradition, including recently when we had a very heated atmosphere at Bomas of Kenya, where chairs were flying. We still managed to have a peaceful transition.
Mm.
Yeah.
The one thing that there's a saying that they usually say, you have not succeeded until your successor succeeds. I think for me, the reason why I keep asking that question is, even in our own context, we heard someone say, this is my preferred.
Yes.
Yeah. In 2002, we had, this is my preferred.
Yes.
But when it got to 2013, we didn't have, this is my preferred. And whoever came in and took the country on a totally different trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, if you're looking at Uganda, you look at Rwanda, and maybe even, would you call it, the whole African continent, even look at South Africa, if you look at the policies that President Ramaphosa has versus Julius Malema has, they are worlds apart.
Mm-hmm.
And ANC currently doesn't look like it has someone who will actually challenge Julius Malema to that seat.
Mm-hmm.
Succession planning is all about ensuring that someone will take us on that trajectory we were going.
Mm-hmm. But most importantly, I think it's also about having providing room for competing ideas, so that you tell us, this is the, you preferred successor.
Mm-hmm.
Through a democratic, of course, process.
Mm-hmm.
So, in this case, if it's a party, your party endorses a candidate, then you have an opposition challenging that idea, and at the end of the day, you have a meaningful discourse that could then lead to, you know. But when it becomes, a choir where you have to, for you to be, to have a chance at clinching the presidency, you have to be within a certain ecosystem, a certain political machine, then that by itself stifles democracy. And I think that is one of the challenges we have in the countries you've mentioned, where the ruling parties are dominant, and either dominant by operation of the law,
mm-hmm.
so that these states are almost de facto one-party states, although that's not so on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that then fuels this monster.
Irene, you looked like you wanted to say something.
No, I wanted to say, in Rwanda and Uganda, I would just bluntly put it that there is no democracy in those two countries. And the reason I'm saying so is that in countries where the opposition is being muzzled to the extent that it would interfere with the electorate having an array of choices to make. In the case of Rwanda, even though, as Okai has put it, Kagame has helped the country since the 1994 genocide, it seems right now like he is gratifying himself for being the man who made the nation have some sort of trajectory. But to the extent that he's now interfering with the will of the electorate, with him extending his term to 20?
He's not the one. He'll actually say he's not the one.
Yes.
91.9%. My question was, where this 0.9% of the party membership, who are they? Because I would like to know. Because I think that's the same percentage he also won in the previous election.
But it cannot be accurate in a country whereby the opposition does not have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Exactly. It means that people cannot come out to boldly say that, like, no.
Alternative ideas.
So it cannot be accurate. The 91.9% cannot be a basis to say that indeed it was not Kagame who sort of influenced this. He influenced it from the very start, that opposition leaders in that country, whether they're in the country or not, they're being intimidated. And it's the same case with Mugabe. With Museveni. Mm-hmm. Museveni is almost turning Uganda into a monarchy because the wife is part of the cabinet, the son is General
Muhoozi
is the, what this was?
The CDF.
CDF, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's, the country is now becoming a monarchy, and therefore the succession plan, even if he had one, it will not be per se the will of the electorate, because it's his conceived idea of how Uganda should be, and that is not democracy. So for the two countries, I don't know how that will turn out. And that's why we had the spate of coups last year in some African states, mm-hmm. because, again, people felt like this is not the true picture of democracy. I think it will happen the same way in Zimbabwe, where we had Mugabe told, my friend, you have to go. This cannot continue. I'm not sure how successful that will be in Rwanda and Uganda, given that the present head of states are military leaders, and therefore they will have an upper hand in terms of tackling any opposition that might come to upset their governance in those countries.
But we have seen, for instance, in Tanzania, when you disagree with what is going on in the ruling party, case in point, the late Lowassa,
yes,
he moved to another party. And even there, he made his point and was allowed to go through to an election and lost. But
because the level of political participation in Tanzania, you cannot compare it to Rwanda. Uganda and Rwanda. Because what these two leaders, who unfortunately are dreading retirement, they have not given room for political participation. In mm-hmm. fact, the level of suppression of dissent is very high in these two countries, that the leaders cannot be able to really stand any leader who opposes any kind of policy.
I would agree with you in the case of Uganda, but in the case of Rwanda, I actually think it is the people who just want President Kagame to be there.
The people who have been polled to support, who are believed to support Kagame's bid, for instance,
mm-hmm.
these are the people who support the government. But the other people whom their voices have been stifled, they have not been given that chance to speak. Because once they do, the possibility of them being...
The beauty about secret ballot is you are allowed to make your voice known without anyone
Before we even get to the ballot, that opposition leaders who have stood out to impede Kagame have not been given an opportunity, that some have been abducted, some have been harassed, some have been assassinated. It shows that even before we get to the ballot, the process has already been interfered with.
The confidence is not there.
The process has already been interfered with. Because if I get to the ballot and I thought I would vote for Kagure has been abducted. He's not even on the ballot paper. How am I supposed to make a political choice in that sense?
Kagame, by the way?
He's still very young. You had something to say in closing. One of our producers is signaling we need to finish.
Yeah, I think ultimately, you know, we have a region that has instability in some of the parts of this region, Somalia, DRC. And the last thing we'd want in this region is more instability. So what I would be worried most about is transitions in this country, in these countries, and what those transitions are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be worried about the transition in Uganda. Are we going to still have a stable Uganda post Museveni? How is that going to be like? Are we going to have another military takeover and have another leader take power through the military route? I think those should be a concerns of leaders in our region. And therefore, we need to have a working, you know, model for democracy that at least guarantees peaceful transition, whichever leader is in power.
And we have to make a peaceful transition to the hype. Thank you, Davis. Thank you, Irene. And thank you, Wakaya. Please do come back again.
Please come back again
so that we can have a great conversation.
Yeah.
And of course, thank you to each one of you out there for listening to us. Please share your comments on our Twitter handles and even on our WhatsApp or even on our SoundCloud page. For now, we say good night and enjoy the rest of the week.